From KLCC News, this is the Northwest Passage. There have been 6 deaths traced to vaping, including one in Oregon. Opioid addiction is leading to overflows at a dusk-to-dawn homeless camp in Eugene, and an update on the case of 400 cats on a Vineta property. Those stories and more on this edition of the Northwest Passage podcast.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this week's Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
And I'm news reporter Brian Bull.
I'm All Things Considered host Angela Keltner.
And I'm news reporter Aubrey Bulkley.
Angela, as All Things Considered host, you've been reading the headlines on KLCC all week. What are some of the top stories?
Well, Rachel, something that really stood out to me this week is all of these cases of severe lung disease, illnesses, and deaths that are linked to vaping. So we have one adult, a middle-aged man in Oregon who died from a respiratory illness tied to vaping cannabis. Now, health officials in Oregon are looking for some of the leftover product that he may have consumed so that they can test it. Then there was also a second Oregon resident who received medical treatment for a severe lung disease linked to vaping. So this has happened in Oregon. Then just on Wednesday, Washington State reported that there was a teenager that was hospitalized for 5 days in August with a severe lung illness related to vaping. And across the country, this is as of Wednesday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there have been roughly 450 cases of the lung disease reported in at least 33 states so far, and as many as 5 people with the illness have died.
Wow.
So they really are trying to pin down what exactly is going on, because some of them are vaping tobacco products containing nicotine. But as we've previously reported, Tiffany Eckert here reported that in the vaping product, there are hundreds of chemicals going into your lungs. Then on the other side, with vaping the cannabis, they're trying to figure out, you know, what's the link? Is there something in the oil in the cartridge? There was a study recently where they were taking biopsies and doing blood tests of these people who had fallen ill, and they had high levels of vitamin E. So they were saying, well, maybe they're using vitamin E in the cartridges, then they're inhaling that and they're getting too much vitamin E, but that does not explain these illnesses and these deaths. So that they have not ruled that out, but they're not saying that's the cause either. So they are trying to figure this out. And then just yesterday on Wednesday, the people in charge of Oregon's legal marijuana retail market, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, they're asking store owners to voluntarily review the products on their shelves and pull any of them that they feel might be unsafe. They're not doing like a mandatory recall. They're just asking the store owners to do this voluntarily, kind of on the honor system. They're also asking marijuana stores to put up signs warning about the potential dangers of vaping. So again, they're really trying to get ahead of this. And also yesterday, Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and some of his colleagues have introduced legislation to tax e-cigarettes. They're hoping that by raising the taxes on these or starting a tax, that it would discourage people from taking it up. Some people say that they wanted to quit smoking cigarettes, so they switched to vaping, thinking it would be a healthier option. And now, as we're seeing, that's not the case. So there's also an issue with flavored e-cigarettes. These are very attractive to young people, and studies have shown that the younger you start smoking, you're more likely to take it up as a habit and be a lifelong smoker or smoke for many years. So the federal government is looking at banning flavored e-cigarettes. So that's something that may be coming out soon. And then finally, on Wednesday, Senator Wyden, Senator Merkley, and about 20 other senators called on the federal government, basically called them out, saying, you're not taking enough action on this. You're slow. This has been going on for a month now. You need to do more to step up what's happening with vaping. So we'll continue to follow that story, especially now that we've had one death in Oregon.
And Angela, just this morning, Thursday morning, President Trump did announce that he wants to ban all flavored e-cigarettes products.
It's really curious, too, about that vitamin E issue. Of all the things that would be an additive to these products, vitamins doesn't seem like a one that would either be a natural addition. And also, too, you very rarely hear of people getting sick or endangered because of a vitamin, but it seems to have triggered something off in their system.
Right. I mean, if they're vaping 5 times a day, 10 times a day, they might be getting really high levels of that vitamin E. But again, that's just one thing that people have tested for. And again, the CDC is taking this very seriously because, again, these are just the cases that we know about. There might be people suffering at home that are having these weird symptoms, but they don't know what's causing it. And then the fact that it's led to 6 deaths across the country, that's something pretty serious. Yeah. So, again, it's something that we're keeping an eye on. And it's nice to see that our Oregon senators are taking up this issue as well so that they can try and make sure that Oregonians are safe, but also people across the country are safe.
And Angela, there were some local stories as well, including the Eugene City Council is considering declaring a state of emergency for the opioid crisis.
That's right. So as we're talking about vaping, whether it's cannabis or tobacco products, people become addicted to those. And so we're seeing that across the country with people talking about the opioid crisis and that people are addicted to opiates. And Jackson County earlier this week did declare addiction as a public health crisis. So the Eugene City Council is looking at that as well. My question as a journalist is, so you declare this a crisis, what are you going to do about it? Is there funding behind it? Are there programs? A lot of studies show that, you know, putting people into recovery programs, getting them, finding ways to get them off of opiates and not just punishing them, saying you're a bad person because you take this medication or you take, you know, illicit opiates like heroin. So finding ways for them to get into treatment and treat the problem rather than just punish them. So, and I was curious about Brian Bull's story this week where he talked to Terry McDonald with St. Vincent de Paul, who similarly said that their shelters are filling up because of people who are addicted to some of these harder drugs. Brian, when you talked to Terry McDonald, what else did he say about that in terms of helping the homeless get shelter for the winter, but also trying to help the ones that are addicted to these really hard drugs?
Well, that's a very good question. And when I talked to Terry McDonald, executive director of St. Vincent's, he said that there are indeed strains of heroin coming out onto the streets.
Some really bad heroin laced with fentanyl. The cost of heroin has dropped down to where it's almost cheaper than marijuana. And when they get to the point where they're cheaper than the recreational type of drug, the marijuanas of the world, it's not a good thing.
What Terry told me was that one of their shelters off of Highway 99, the Dusk to Dawn tent camp that's been around for 3+ years, is already practically at capacity. They have 200 spaces in this facility. 190 are already taken. And this is well ahead of winter, which is when they usually hit peak capacity. We're not even done with summer, technically. And already they've are pretty much already at 95%. And so as far as being able to address the addiction angle of it, you know, there are always support systems in place, both for the addict personally on the streets and also healthcare services. It's a very difficult addiction to crack. Mm-hmm. What they can do on their end, St. Vincent's and other organizations, is simply try to get people into affordable housing as soon as possible to avoid this overcrowding situation. It is significant, though, because opioid addiction is now being recognized as a national epidemic. And so this is just part of the ripple effect, I think, that we're seeing. A very good resource right now, just to give you kind of an indicator, is a opioid map that the Washington Post put out just a few weeks ago. It's accessible by everyone. There's no payment firewall, where you can see where opioid pills have been sold per person to county. And this is a very telling graphic. And so Curry County, Josephine County, I think are the darkest spots in Oregon's map. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it averages out to about somewhere like between 80 to 90 pills per person. And there were some even scarier, darker spots on the map in places like Kentucky, and I believe Nevada has a very affected county too. Mm-hmm. So they are trying to work through, but at this point, the best they can do is simply try to get people moved in and out of that space as soon as possible. On a related note, tangentially about the theme of addiction, we have what seems to be a very unchecked case of animal hoarding without spaying or neutering, paying off, well, I shouldn't say paying off, resulting in an exponential catastrophe, to use a terrible pun. There is a home in Veneta, just outside the town, I should say, that has been overrun with an estimated 300 to 400 cats. It's very difficult to know the exact numbers. The animals don't simply line up and wait to be counted. But there are some on-site people that say that the original 400 count may be a little overestimated. But they have some relief now. Since we first covered the story roughly a month ago, a national organization has stepped in. They're called Alley Cat Allies. They've been around since 1990. They're based in Bethesda, Maryland. And their president and founder, Becky Robinson, tells me that they've sent about half a dozen specialists to set up feeding stations and adequate shelter on their site. It's starting to get a little cold and rainy now. But now they're going to start doing trap, neuter, and release, TNR for short. And the Green Hill Humane Society is partnering up with them in this effort. And as of Wednesday morning, they've had 42 cats and 3 kittens removed from the property. Here's Green Hill's executive director, Carrie Lieberman.
For those that we've identified as feral, they will be spayed and neutered, identified any, if they need any medical care. They receive their vaccinations. And assuming that they're otherwise healthy, they'll go back the next day to the property. Those that are friendly or might be good for adoption, they're going to be with us probably for a couple weeks.
So, Brian, I have a question. Is there a homeowner at this property, or it's just a vacant lot?
It is owned, and the person who owns the property has been in the hospital for more than a month. And her daughter-in-law, when I talked to her, believes that initially what happened was about 13 years ago, there was a mama cat and 5 kittens, and they were just never fixed. And I'm sure incoming cats from surrounding areas showed up and eventually had a little cat colony forming, and it just went from there. She believes that her mother-in-law has been hospitalized because of living in a tight situation, a tight climate, where you're surrounded by hundreds of animals. And you think about the waste, you think about everything from the dander, the fur, maybe diseases that have been brought in by these animals. It doesn't seem like they've received any veterinary care at all, from what I'm gathering. And so living in such tight conditions basically brought her to the hospital, where I believe she still remains to this day. It's owned. The county has deemed it an unsafe property for people. The daughter-in-law also warned one of the visitors there when I was there last not to go inside because there's a family of skunks living inside the house. So you can just imagine that, yeah, this is about something that's been kind of brewing for some time. But hopefully now with Alley Cat Allies, they've been working with large groups of cats in urgent situations like this for, gosh, about almost 30 years. They seem pretty well equipped to handle this. The people I talked to at Green Hill seem very comfortable working with them, and they've done everything from taking care of the cats under Atlantic City's boardwalk to helping cats out following wildfires and big disasters like hurricanes. Oh, and then the other detail, the other news story that we were following up on has to do with a pending labor strike at the McKenzie Willamette Medical Center in Springfield. In short, they reached an agreement just over a week ago. The contract was approved, and so now workers, about 400, have approved the deal between themselves and management, and they are going to receive, quote-unquote, the largest yearly wage increases in over a decade. They are saying housekeepers are going to earn nursing assistants, service coordinators, dietary workers, and housekeepers are going to earn a market rate adjustment of up to 4% or more. Wages are to increase up to 17%, with most of the McKenzie Willamette workers seeing a more than 12% wage increase, putting them on a more equitable pay scale with the hospital workers at the nearby Peace Health Sacred Heart Medical Center. It sounds like a strike has been averted. It would have turned into a 3-day strike, but now that's been abated, and I believe the contract's good for 2 years.
Thanks, Brian. And of course, remember, you can find all of KLCC's reporting and Brian's recent reporting on our website, klcc.org. Now, Aubrey, you've been working here in the KLCC newsroom this week, and you spoke with a City of Eugene planner who's part of the development of the downtown park blocks, where they're trying to make sort of a transformation take place.
Yeah, so I spoke with him this week about their last meeting that they're having. They've actually had a series of meetings since, I believe, May of this year. What's known as the Butterfly Lot on 8th and Oak is going to be transformed into a new city hall and hopefully a more permanent place for the Lane County Farmers Market. And with that, they wanted to kind of look at the neighboring blocks that are currently called the Park Blocks in downtown Eugene that are utilized for various things like the Saturday Market and whatnot, but could potentially be utilized better, especially if they were renovated at the same time. For the past few months, they've been soliciting input from the community about what would be the best use of this space and how they would like to see that transform. And so earlier this summer, they had a meeting in the Park Blocks that they gave three kind of different options of how that space could look and had people vote on various things. I actually had a chance to go to that event, which was really cool because they had various points in a survey where you could give your opinion of what sort of trees you'd like to have in the space, if they put stages in, how many, and what kind of orientation those should be in, especially if it were a large show where lots of people would like to show up, you know, how should we try and fit all those people, things like that. And they then took all of that information. Over 1,500 people gave their opinions to the team working on this. And they now have come up with a final draft of the concept that they are going to be presenting today, Thursday, at the Park Blocks and getting more feedback about, okay, we took all of your input and this is kind of the best option of everything that you told us. And what do you think of it? And how can we continue to improve it? Once they get that feedback, they will come up with an actual final draft of the concept to give to Eugene City Council to then have the City Council decide whether or not they want to move forward with that plan and so on.
I'm getting this impression that all across Eugene, they're going to be fast-tracking a lot of these developments ahead of the 2021 IAAF.
Yeah.
I guess because it's putting out a placemat, a visual placemat for the, what is it, roughly estimated 55,000 visitors?
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah, and I mean, the interesting thing with this project is this is part of the City Hall project, and the City Hall, a new Eugene City Hall, has been in the works for a very long time. So if they can accomplish that in time for the 2021 World Championships, that will be amazing.
Definitely.
A miracle.
Yeah.
You're listening to KLCC's Northwest Passage. We'll be right back.
Support for KLCC's Northwest Passage is provided by Columbia Bank. Columbia Bank team members have experience in the unique challenges of multiple industries, from healthcare to manufacturing. Learn more about their services for the business community at columbiabank.com. Columbia Bank, where relationships rule. Member FDIC.
Welcome back to the Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald with All Things Considered host Angela Kellner and reporters Brian Bull and Aubrey Bulkley. Folks, what other stories are on your mind this week?
So my story is a social media viral sensation that has a lot of people, including myself, puzzled. Many times as you go through your Twitter feed or your Facebook page, it's not unusual to see people sharing these little video recipes. They're often sped up footage, and it's a quick tutorial on how to make some interesting, intriguing dish. But one that seems to have really taken off since it was first launched in early August is what people are essentially calling the barbecue quesadilla pizza something.
Okay.
And it's only about 2.5 minutes from start to finish, again, because it's sped up footage, but It's very bizarre. I joke that if your turducken needs an appetizer and you have 20 hours of free time, this is the recipe for you. Essentially, it starts off, you think you're going to be making barbecue chicken. There's chicken breasts in a baking pan. You dice up your onions and your peppers, and you bake it, and you shred it, and you think, oh, great, barbecue chicken. Oh, wait, no, there's more. Then you put it in a springform pan between two tortillas, and now it's a quesadilla with barbecue chicken. You're thinking, great. But no, there's more. You have to roll it in breadcrumbs, I believe, and deep fry it. And so you're thinking, great, deep fried barbecue pizza, barbecue quesadilla thingy. No, there's more. They then have you actually coat it with mozzarella and pepperoni and marinara sauce and bake it. But they're not done with you yet. At the very tag end, they show you how to do a ranch dressing from scratch, which you then dip it into and serve. And a lot of people, including NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben, have undertaken this. And there's debate as to whether this is a bona fide recipe or if it's some kind of parody. It just goes on and on and on. And for a lot of people, it looks like something that would just kill you after your first piece.
So, Brian, I know you are a gourmet chef. Are you going to try this out at home for your family?
I'm not that ambitious. It's kind of this culinary abomination that is intriguing and terrifying at the same time. If anyone else were to make one, I would be happy to try a bite. But it
next
just
KLCC potluck.
Yeah, it just seems to be the never-ending recipe, and what you get in the end, it just seems like four entrees that did a head-on collision in your oven, and you just don't know where to go with it. But apparently, some people have made it, and some people claim to actually like it.
Well, one of the stories that we aired this week was from KLCC's correspondent Tom Bonsi, and he was telling us sort of a historical story about these this group of paratroopers who were stationed in Pendleton, Oregon, during World War II, and their assignment was to defuse these Japanese balloon bombs, and they were also firefighters, and they're African American. And the story talks about the racism that they faced in Pendleton and the work that they did. And Pendleton is finally recognizing them with a historical marker. Tom was able to talk with one of the former paratroopers who wasn't able to make it to the ceremony in Pendleton.
96-year-old former Sergeant J.J. Corbett says the reception the elite troops got varied from friendly to racist.
We met people who, for the first time, they said they had never seen colored folks.
Corbett distinctly remembers being taken aback by the signs on some business doors.
During that time, we saw signs, no dogs and Indians are allowed.
The African-American soldiers learned the prohibition applied to them, too.
The folks putting this together in Pendleton are trying to sort of make up for what the troops faced. So it's a good historical piece from Bonsi this week.
It's nice to see them get that recognition, too.
Yeah, and to learn a little more about our history. I certainly wasn't aware of that.
In my former life, I was a first grade teacher, and so I have a lot of teacher friends and that I'm still friends with on Facebook. And this morning, I read a really sweet post from a former colleague of mine, and he was like, this is not political. So, of course, I was intrigued. All right, what's not political? And he goes on to explain this beautiful story about how I believe he teaches middle school. And he has a fridge in his classroom, you know, to keep snacks and things like that. And it's this red fridge. He had posted a picture of it a couple days before. They had decorated it, I think. And the class was having this discussion about what to name the fridge. And so one of the kids got this idea of like, oh, my gosh, we need to have an important person weigh in on this. And that student decided to email a bunch of politicians and see if any of them could, you know, give a response. And so he goes on to say that within an hour, the student had a response from a staffer on Pete Buttigieg's campaign. And they were like, well, can you send us a picture of this fridge so we can, like, think of names? And so they did. The kid took a picture, sent the picture back. And by the end of the day, basically within a few hours, they had responded saying that they should name the fridge Pete Buttigieg.
Ah.
And
a little self-referential.
Yes, self-referential.
Very clever.
For sure. Very clever. But what he wrote at the end was, regardless of whether or not you like his politics, he must have some good staffers working for him. How cool that they took the time to reply to this teenage kid who, like, can't even vote or anything like that. And then the comments below were fantastic. Like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And just, you know, how someone was like, I never would have thought to email a politician. And just what a great way to teach kids, too, that you can reach out and you might actually get a response.
I thought they were going to name it Calvin Cool Fridge.
Oh, that would have been good, too.
From a historical perspective.
I don't know if they officially named it that or not, but that was their suggestion. And I thought that was really sweet.
People name refrigerators now.
And Angela, you have something to take us
I
out
do.
On?
I do. So I always check the NPR website every day. Once I scroll through the main page of headlines and top stories, I always like to go down to the bottom and click on, there's two spots I always check, arts and life and music. So just the other day I was in here finishing up and I clicked on music, and there, behold, was my very favorite reggae artist, Damien Junior Gong Marley, was doing an NPR Tiny Desk concert. So it made my day. I didn't watch it right then because I was still working, but I did go home and watch it. You know, so many amazing and famous musicians have done NPR Tiny Desk concerts. They're usually about 15, 20 minutes long. Lizzo just did a great one. So you really kind of get this intimate look and listen to these artists because they're in this small space. They can't bring their full band. It's usually more acoustic. So that's what Damien Marley did. He had his two female backup singers and then about four or five musicians. And he did three songs acoustic. He kind of introduced each one. So for me, it just was a happy day, happy moment to see that Damien Marley was on the NPR Tiny Desk concert this week.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Angela, and thanks to everyone for joining us for KLCC's Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm News Reporter Brian Bull.
I'm All Things Considered host Angela Keldner.
And I'm News Reporter Aubrey Bulkley.
Bye.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.
Working for your dollar bill. Sad to see the old slave mill is grinding slow but grinding still. And walking home a child gets killed. Neighbors free to shoot at will. Sad to see that old slave mill is grinding slow but grinding still. And 9 to 5, you know the drill. Weekends are a short-lived thrill. Sad to see.